Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Helen Phillips joined us a while back to talk about her novel, The Need. It was longlisted for the National Book Award in 2019. Motherhood was one of the main themes in The Need, and motherhood plays a big part in Helen's latest novel, Hum. The protagonist, Mae Webb, has lost her job to artificial intelligence. Her family is drowning in debt. So Mae decides to make some money by participating in an experiment that changes her face so that surveillance cameras cannot recognize it. Hum takes place in a near-future world that may not be too far off from our own. It has been impacted by climate change and is populated by intelligent and sometimes invasive robots called Hums. Helen's novel follows Mae's struggle to cope in this dystopian world.
It's very much a book about motherhood. All of the other elements of the book aside, the technology and the climate change and the artificial intelligence, this is really a book about motherhood and about a mother trying to do the right thing for her children and stumbling along the way.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Your novels and short stories explore the alienating effects of surveillance capitalism. What is it about surveillance capitalism that interests you?
Well, I'll answer that by telling a little anecdote that
Please.
Was one of the seeds of Hum. So one day, some years ago, I was walking home from work and the thought crossed my mind, I really need some new dish rags. I haven't bought new dish rags in a while. I arrived home and opened my computer and dish rags were instantaneously advertised to me. I think a lot of us have had experiences along these lines. And it was quite an eerie sensation. Wait, did they enter my mind? How did they know? Did I say it out loud? That feeling of being surveilled. But then I think I went ahead and even bought those dish rags because they're just dish rags. It's not a big deal. But it did get me going along a line of thinking of, okay, what would be the worst possible outcome of that kind of surveillance? Why does this give me such a troubled feeling? And what would happen if I wrote a novel where I put a character in a situation where that surveillance really leads to much bigger problems than just feeling a little strange that they know you want dish rags?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. You have created this very interesting world that seems to be set in the near future and is not all that different from our own. And as you mentioned, it includes these intelligent robots called Hums. Can you tell us a bit more about what role the Hums play in this society?
Hum is obviously the title of the book, and I'll use that name as a way of exploring this question. So I was fortunate with this book that the title came to me very early on in the process. For The Need, the title was the last thing that came to me. But once I knew that these robots would be called Hums, I knew that Hum would be the title. And that title is very meaningful to me in the book because I feel like it has a duality in it that is also encapsulated in the characters of the Hums. So on the one hand, a hum for me can be the low, relentless sound of all of our devices, the simmer of the internet, the simmer of all of our machines, a sound that you can never quite quiet, that it's always there. And on the other hand, hum is a very beautiful word. It calls to mind maybe someone humming a lullaby to their children. It calls to mind potentially the sacred sound Om. And that duality of being a machine, a relentless machine, and having this other element that is almost divine or comforting, the Hums contain both of those sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. The Hums use their torso screens to constantly promote and sell products and services to the humans. Would it be fair to say that this annoying Amazonian form of advertising is something that will be with us soon if it isn't already?
Yes, I think that as the book has gone out into the world, I certainly feel that readers relate very much to that aspect of the book, even though, yes, it's futuristic because they are embodied robots. The feeling of screens that are constantly trying to advertise to you and also advertise to you in quite a targeted and personal way, I think is perhaps one of the elements of my futuristic book that is relatively quite close to where we are now.
Mm-hmm. Hum opens with your protagonist, Mae Webb, undergoing surgery. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So as I mentioned, she has lost her job to artificial intelligence. And one way she's figured out to make money is to be a guinea pig in this experiment that will alter the 68 points of her face print so that she can't be identified by surveillance. And the book begins with literally the needle of this operation inching closer to her face. A hum is doing this procedure, completing this surgery on her. And it certainly is an intense moment to enter the narrative. I have definitely heard that from readers, that you definitely are thrown right in.
Mm-hmm. Why did you want to write about facial recognition surveillance?
I think it's very interesting and very eerie. I read some interesting articles about it too along the way. So while I was working on the book, Kashmir Hill of the New York Times published a piece about a startup. I'll share with you the title of the piece. I have it right here in the end notes to the book. The article is called "Your Face is Not Your Own." When a secretive startup scraped the internet to build a facial recognition tool, it tested a legal and ethical limit and blew the future of privacy in America wide open. So Kashmir's reporting on that, it was really fascinating to me. There was also an article in The New Yorker by John Seabrook called "The Adversarial Man" that was about people who are trying to create different ways to defy that kind of surveillance through makeup or costumes. So this idea of even just by walking out into the world, your face makes you not anonymous if you have this kind of surveillance. And what do we do about that? Are the benefits of it outweighing the downsides? I don't necessarily think so. I just wanted to explore the question of this kind of really insidious surveillance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have said that when you start to write a book, you are setting out to confront and explore your fears. What kinds of fears were you dealing with when you started working on Hum?
Yes, you quote me correctly, and indeed that's true. So I was thinking about the future, and I was feeling anxiety about climate change as it creeps and rushes in on us and the effects of that. I was thinking about artificial intelligence and both the benefits and potential threats that that creates, and just the technological capitalist society that we exist in, all of those things, and really looking at those and thinking about those as a mother and thinking about the world into which I'm raising my children.
Mm-hmm. Did writing about these fears help you become less afraid, or did they make you feel even more frightened?
The book is a process of confronting the fears, and I think that that is a good process to go through. I think that the fear is maybe more nuanced now, but I did find and truly was in search of notes of hope as I look to the future. So I conducted a number of interviews, and I was really interested across my interview subjects who are in different fields like sociology or international development. I would ask them at the beginning of the interview, what are you worried about? And then at the end of the interview, I would ask, what gives you hope? And across the interviews, there came a consistency of response to that second question, which was communal action, collective action is something that gives me hope. When people come together, they can solve problems in a way that we can't do individually. And so that was a very hopeful note for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's clear that you have done a lot of research on artificial intelligence. What is your take on AI?
Well, one book that I read early on informed me on that front, and it's called The Artist and the Machine by Arthur I. Miller. And Miller takes a more positive view of the potential human-AI collaborations, not just, oh, the robots will destroy us all, but more looking at the really positive possibilities for artistic creation created by humans and AIs. And so that was one element of my research that informed the characters of the Hums. That said, I feel complicated about it. I do feel that humans have a tendency to attribute empathy to robots, But really, you need another human to be on the other end of your conversation for it to be real empathy. And we find it easy to forget that. Another source I read was Sherry Turkle's book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. And she has some passages about this issue that children especially and adults can really feel like they're having an interaction with a robot where they are experiencing empathy. But it isn't empathy. It is a machine.
Very well said. Very good point. May's family spends a lot of time in their individual wombs. They seem to be some kind of high-tech bedrooms. How would you describe them?
So the wombs, W-O-O-Ms, are these egg-shaped capsules that are subsidized by advertisers. So they are high-tech, but they are also ubiquitous in this society. So May and her family are struggling financially, but even they have four wombs, one for each member of the family. And you can go into the womb and close the shade, and it will stream the internet on the walls of the womb, and you can select different experiences to have. So on the one hand, it's a place of solitude and relaxation, you could say, but it's also a place that people go to be alone and be isolated and choose that over connection with their family.
Mm-hmm. And there's also this element of accessing memories and streaming services, right?
Yes, yes. You can stream past photographs and past videos. You can be reminded of things that you searched for in the past. And actually, that technology gets its name, Womb, W-O-O-M, because there's one setting where you can make it actually feel like a womb. So the walls will turn red and kind of pink veined like the womb. And there will be the sound of a distant heartbeat. And so sometimes people just curl up in their wombs to kind of literally go back into the womb. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that is one use of the technology in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You raise a lot of important questions in Hum, like how we might dose our technologies, how might we dose our usage of our planet, how might we dose our children's independence from us. These are all big questions, and you've probably been too busy, but have you come up with any answers to these questions?
Well, I'm glad you bring up that question, and I'm actually going to read the epigraph to the book, which that question really is referring to. So the epigraph to the book is from Paracelsus, who was a physician in the 1400s. And Paracelsus said, "Poison is in everything, and no thing is without poison. The dosage makes it either a poison or a remedy." To me, that is very much a quote that captures how I feel about technology. The technologies that we have are incredible tools, and we can't get rid of them, but how can we have a good relationship with them? How can we dose them so that they're a remedy, not a poison? And that quote I selected as the epigraph because that's really one of the driving questions of the book. What is the right relationship to have with a hum? What is the right relationship to have with your womb? I don't know that I have arrived at any clear answers. The book is really existing in that gray area. But certainly, personally, I try to have a time where I take a break from my email, take a break from my phone, just put it away and really remove my eyes from the screen and try to ground myself fully in the physical world and the people around me.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. You wrote a story for The Atlantic that I think was published in 2016. I can't remember the title of it. It was just two words, The Wall?
The Wall, that's wall. Correct.
Yeah, and it seemed to me after reading it, and that was a really great story. I really enjoyed reading it. It seemed to me that was kind of an early draft for Hum.
That's an interesting point. That was an early story in my writing life where I was writing into a near future and examining a family in that context. So I've actually never drawn that line in my own mind before, but you're probably right that was a little bit of a Petri dish for my later work.
Mm-hmm. I think it was for sure. Oh, sure. That's interesting because especially the two kids, the children that are the main characters, I would say, or among the main characters, they reminded me of May's kids in Hum.
That's true. And actually, now that you're saying it, I'm smiling because the child in that story is named Lulu, and in the book, the daughter is named Lou. So clearly, there is a connection there.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Helen Phillips, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Hum. It's a beautifully written novel that is very relevant to the way we live now. Perhaps a little too relevant, but you know, that's kind of out of our control. I hope that Hum wins the National Book Award. Fingers crossed.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to speak with you again, and I really appreciate your support.
Helen Phillips is the author of Hum. Find out more about Helen and Hum at wpr.org/beta.
June 25th, 1982. And that was the day that both Blade Runner and The Thing opened on the same day, which is hard to fathom. And they were both dismissed by critics.
Coming up, author Chris Nashawaty on the summer that changed everything for sci-fi movies. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. このボタン押せば音楽奏でる